And then we'll read the first page again. So we went over the five forces quite quickly, so I thought I'd just say them again. So we have two kinds of five forces, or two applications of the five forces. And the first one is throughout the life, and the last one is specifically at the time of death, and that's what's called Mahayana transference. And if you are someone who does the Lama Chopa, there is the verse, you know, that may we be able to practice the, how does it go, the transference, Mahayana transference of mind, I think. It's like at the time of death. So that's what this is talking about. So the five forces is like the essential instructions of how to practice Dharma. So, you know, first we have to hear about the benefits of bodhicitta. And then generally we meet someone who inspires us by their behavior. Marianne was very sweet. She said, she told me that there was a film team at the 1985 Kalachakra that was Roland and Jeff Jukes, and I don't know who else. And she didn't know about Dharma yet, but she said it was a job. She could be the secretary to come and write down the, whatever it was, the films, you know, whatever they took. And she said, more so than, well, she didn't say it like that. She said it was the behavior of Roland and Jeff and the other people. I don't know if there were other, were there other people? Or was it just, yeah, a few other people. Seven, the crew of seven people. It wasn't the teachings, it was the behavior of the people that inspired her to practice Dharma. And I can say the same. When I went to my first course with Lama Yeshe, I mean, Lama Yeshe was great, there's no doubt about that. But what really encouraged me was the Vajrapani Institute people. You know, it was the nicest group of people I'd ever met, and I wanted them to be my friends, you know. So never underestimate how important it is that we behave. You know, we try to practice these trainings. Because more than the teachings, what brings people to Dharma is the feeling of the people who practice Dharma. You know? Because in this day and age, there's lots of spiritual traditions out there. And we have them all at our fingertips. We just have to punch a button on the internet. We can watch YouTubes of everybody. You know? But what we don't have enough of now is real people. Because as much as everyone's completely enamored with YouTubes and Facebook and all this stuff, that only affects a tiny bit of our awareness and consciousness as the things we see with on the screens. You know, there's so much more to human interaction based on a real body. You know, they say there's something like, what is it, like 10% of communication is just verbal? The rest of it is just, you know, the hormones we put out and the way we feel and the way we move. And so and people really respond to that if we ever have a chance to be with people, if it's not just Facebook anymore. You know, everyone's so into it. There's nothing wrong with it. But all I'm saying is that when we are genuine human beings who are authentic with our own feelings, you know, I think it's more important than trying to be a good person is to be a real person, you know. Mm-hmm. Like if I'm feeling shitty that day, you know, I can try to be cheerful, but I'm not going to deny that, you know. Or if I'm heartbroken, I'm heartbroken, you know. And I think that we make a mistake in Dharma to think that we can't feel our feelings, you know. Probably this group is mature enough to know that, but when we sit down to meditate, we should never push away, you know, things that are bothering us. They need to be just come and, you know. And I really like what Pema Chodron said. I remember reading it a long, long time ago. She said, what's really helpful is if you can just drop the storyline, you know. he did this, she did this, da 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 da. There's always a story, but try to feel where that story is in your body and sit with that energy and do that breathing meditation just like we were doing. And eventually that energy is, if you don't push it away, you don't have to like follow the thoughts and make it a bigger story, but just sit with it. Breathing in, breathing out, there it is. Oh, my broken heart. Oh, my jealous feeling. Oh, my anger. It's there. Be real. You know, it's there. Breathe it in, breathe it out. Eventually it gets less and less. And then that's how we become more people, I guess the word's authentic, but people who are living a real life of our feelings and who we are, and then we can interact with other people's feelings. And I really believe, this is just something I decided, came to, that that's what we're attracted to in lamas and Tibetans in general, not all Tibetans, but, you know, is that they're really, there's no barrier between their heart, what's on the inside and what's on the outside, you know. And I think it was my father who told me that, what's the philosopher? I can't remember his name right now. It'll come to me in a minute. He wrote that book about Job, you know, the book of Job, and I think he's Israeli Jewish. He'll come to me in a minute. But he said, my dad told me this when I was younger, that the sign of a, you know, developed personality is when the inside's the same as the outside. You know, we're no longer hiding things. And so when we're authentic and transparent about who we are, but of course then we really need to work on ourselves. We can't pretend, you know. Then we really need to practice Tonglen and thought training, and then it becomes much more imperative. And then we're inspired to do it, because when we're really real about what we are, we realize, whoa, you know, I've got a lot of afflictions going on in here, you know. And so then we want to use the refuge in bodhicitta, use the Tonglen to be present and to heal ourselves, not pretend that the pain isn't there, you know. That's not being a good Buddhist, you know. And then, of course, that's when we really have to practice the thought training, because then it comes into all the things we were talking about yesterday about how we cannot blame others for what happens and how we are responsible to keep us happy. We, you know, happiness is a state of mind. We are responsible for our happiness, and we can be happy, especially if we do what I was saying, you know. Connect with the guru, take refuge, take bodhicitta, let the feelings come up, let them dissolve. Use our thinking, use our brain to find the mind training that's going to work for that particular thing that's keeping me from feeling loving and open today. You know? But that takes courage, and it also takes a willingness to wake up every morning and be honest about myself and decide that I really want to work on myself before I go out, get out of bed and go to work, you know. And I think what is the key is inspiration, you know. How do we stay inspired, you know? We have friends, we go to teachings, we have a Dharma group, we talk about it with our spouse, we read books, we share books. Now there's YouTubes, you know. But I think that's why we're told, you know, in the tantric path that guru devotion is the root of the path. And it's not because we need to go around following gurus and it's all important, you know, oh, the guru likes me, the guru doesn't like me. That's all bullshit. But what's important is keeping that inspiration, that connection with our aspiration for enlightenment, remembering, you know, what that mind is, what that Vajra mind is. And knowing that that's what I want. You know, that's the most important thing in my life. Because I'm going to have many lives, you know. And that's the only thing that's going to get me through all these lives. Is that Vajra mind that's the diamond, the sun, and the medicinal tree. And, you know, the guru has it. And I want it. So if we continue to remember the kindness of the guru and the qualities of the guru... You know, when in the teachings on guru devotion, He tell you, how do you practice guru devotion? You remember the qualities of the guru. You remember his kindness. And that's not because the guru needs or anything. It's because we need, it's to keep us inspired. You know? Yeah.
I think it's quite a stupid and Western thought. But when I tried it before, I find myself, I feel it's not right because the guru never agreed to this. Or I cannot ask this from another person who doesn't even know me.
He doesn't care. But Buddhas don't care. Buddhas are there for everybody, you know? That's kind of like putting a human thought into a Buddha's mind. The Buddha is there. I mean, just... You think about what that meditation we were just doing. We were sending light out to every single sentient being, you know? And that's like pretending that we're a Buddha. A Buddha is sending light out to every single sentient being. And all you got to do is raise your hand up and say, I want a taste of that, and it's there. You know? And they do it effortlessly, and they don't have a sense of, I don't know this person. You know, if you read the Guru Devotion teachings, it says the qualities, you know, of a Buddha is that they love everybody, no matter, completely unconditional. Doesn't matter if they ever met him or if they ever. And if you ever meet one of these lamas, you'll see that the first time you meet them, they hold your hand and look at you and look right into your eyes and go, "Oh my dear, you know, how are you? How can I help you?" And you can feel that love, you know. So I think in your mind it's a limitation that you're putting on yourself that comes from a human, and you have to understand that Buddhas aren't humans. Does that help, Ellen?
The teacher I'm thinking about is definitely a human.
But the Buddha nature, the Buddha mind is beyond that, you know. And also, you know, we have to be really careful when I talk about gurus and teachers. Not all of them are worthy of being connected to. You know, there's a lot of people out there that set themselves up as gurus, you know. So we have to make sure, like if we talk about the Dalai Lama, you know, that one for sure, we know, you know. It's like that's safe, you know. But you have to be careful about how we get attached to. And I think, you know, we were talking earlier, it's a bit of a shame with FPMT that they're so limited in who they can bring here. But that's because they're keeping us safe. You know, that the people, that the teachers that they allow to come to the FPMT centers, they know are good people, you know, and may not be enlightened, but at least they have some connection, you know, like me, you know, I have some connection, you know. I love my gurus, you know, I love Buddha, I love Dharma, I love Sangha, you know, I love the whole thing. So, you know, and I'm a sincere person who's working on my self-cherishing ignorance, you know, so... Hopefully, I'll catch myself if I'm doing something unkind. You know, I mean, I still make mistakes. Just a few, you know, just a month ago, I did something I really regretted. You know, so yeah. Anyway, it's just something. It's work with it, and maybe talk to Losung some more. But yeah, no, they don't care. They don't mind, right? You agree?
I wouldn't mind. Is that a personal question? I don't know.
Yeah.
If some student would imagine you as their guru, would that bother you?
Probably. But because I don't think of it as me, you know. I don't feel like I'm qualified to be anybody's guru, you know. And if people look at me, I go, oh no, you want to go on up the ladder to Lama Zopa Rinpoche, you know, because he has the capacity to be someone's teacher. I don't, you know. I'm just like the messenger, you know. Yeah. And you know, it's good that Rinpoche has lieutenants all over the world. That's how I feel like we're like his lieutenants going around, you know, because he can't go everywhere all the time, you know. And it might not be Rinpoche. I might introduce you to the concept, but then you find out, I have more of a connection with, Ponlat Rinpoche or Akam Rinpoche, he's passed away, or Mingyur Rinpoche, or, you know, I can't say, you know. It's good, and it's good to check, you know, it's good to look around. So we better get to the text. So will, I got all inspired, you know, you got to have the will. So what gives you the will? The will is the devotion, you know, like, because you got to have the will. It's the first thing, you know, you got to have the will. You got to want to get bodhicitta. You have to want to be happy, you know. Some people don't. So, you know, so then once you have the will, then you have to study. You have to learn what it is. You have to become familiar with it. You have to memorize it. You have to do it over and over and over again until it becomes something that is there, part of you, you know. So you have to become familiar with it. That's all meditation is becoming familiar with what it is we're trying to transform in our minds, you know. And then, you know, familiarity and work isn't enough, because then we come up against the wall of karma. Bam, karma. Oh, I have this karma. You know, I don't feel worthy, or I have, you know, this tendency to, like, I just want to gamble all the time, you know. As much as I know I shouldn't go gambling, I want to gamble all the time. So what am I going to do about that? Well, okay, and then the next one is the white seed, purifying karmas. So if we want to make our path speedier, we do practices of purification, and I won't go into that. You probably know what they are. And then we do other things to create merit, you know. Just things like offering flowers, or there's so many ways. Creating merit is just doing something virtuous with the motivation to attain enlightenment, you know. And Kirti Sensei Rinpoche said, and this is very tricky, he said, really, the only way we create the cause to enlightenment is when we are thinking about emptiness at the same time. So that makes it tough. But that's why at least we can dedicate with emptiness. You know, I think that might suffice to squeeze into the door of how to create the cause for enlightenment. Otherwise, you know, we're creating the cause for future happiness, but not necessarily for enlightenment. So it's like I said yesterday, you want to have the nice boat and put all the fuel in the boat, but you want to make sure it goes to where you want to go. So that's why we have to have our motivation and our dedication. So then we create merit, we abandon self-cherishing, and then we pray, make requests, you know, where we want to go, you know, how we want to manifest. Pray to be, you know, there's so many beautiful prayers you can read if you don't have your own prayers. But I think it's really helpful to say your own prayers from your own heart sometimes. I mean, it's nice to read these beautiful prayers, but, you know, I sometimes listen to a spiritual teacher called Carolyn Miss. She's sort of interdenominational, you know, but I really liked it. One day I listened, she said, you have to shout to God, you know. You have to, like, really go out there and say, you know, I'm suffering, I need this help, you know. And I never did that before, and I was in Shetland, and I went out by the ocean. I started shouting, you know, to the guru, you know. It helped, believe it or not. I don't mean it like that, but I mean, you can do it like that. But the thing is that, you know, the greatest prayers, I think, are when you know what you really need. You have to figure out what you really need, and then ask for it. You know, what's going to help you to attain enlightenment? You know, where am I stuck right now? I'm stuck. I'm stuck because I have, well, what you just said. You know, I'm afraid to ask. I'm afraid to feel a blessing of the guru because I don't know if they want it. I don't know if they want me to ask them. I mean, okay, how can I move through that if I want to? You know, I mean, just think about it. So I'm saying, you know, it's great to read these already scripted prayers, but it's also great to do something that you really need. You know. My daughter's sick right now. How can I help? How can I, you know, I really need some help here, you know? Something like that. So then the five at the time of death is to pray to never be separated from bodhicitta at the time of death. Then all through the life, familiarize ourselves with bodhicitta. And particularly, we should do these five powers before we go to sleep at night. So we remember the qualities and why we want bodhicitta. We generate bodhicitta before we go to sleep. And then we give everything away. We just give everything away that we have, so that when we actually go to leave the body, we don't look back and go, oh, there's my diamond necklace. Wow, I really, boy, can I let go of that? Or there's my grandchild. Oh, my, you know. We want to be able to go. And the body, we have to be able to let go of the body, you know. And luckily, I think in some ways old age is a good thing. Because, you know, we're not those pretty young things anymore. It's like, oh, God, this disgusting body, I can't wait to get out of it, you know. So it's kind of good if we can die as we get older, you know. I think it's probably easier to let it go. And then we have give away everything. Do some kind of purification to restore the vows is four. And then go to sleep doing Tonglen. You know, actually do Tonglen as you go to sleep at night. And so hopefully if you were in hospital dying or at bed and dying, you'd remember to do that. You know, that's why we don't want to get hit by a car and die that way, if possible. Yeah. Okay, so those are those. Now we have to, we don't have a lot of time. We have to get through all the rest. But that's okay. If I don't get through them all, you can read them. So I think we'll go about 15 minutes and we'll have a break. So we move on to number five. So let's read that one, the measurement of success in training the mind. Okay? The measurement of success in training the mind. Oh, go on. All dharma is condensed into one purpose. No, no. I'll read it in English. You read it in English.
Alles dharma kondensiert sich zu einem Zweck.
Hold to the principle of the two witnesses. Always rely on a happy mind alone. The indication of having trained is reversal. The sign of having trained is possessing the five greatnesses. One is trained if one is able to practice when distracted.
Yeah, in the German text, I put two times, like, always keep a happy mind. Maybe it means so.
It does. Yeah. Okay, so the first one is pretty simple. I'll go quickly unless it needs some discussion. So all dharma is condensed into one purpose. Of course, we know what that is. The one purpose is reducing our ignorance, that things exist from their own side, and from that becomes our ego-centered preoccupation with ourself and me and mine. So it's basically what we talked about yesterday. We have the two wings of the bird of enlightenment. We have the true nature of reality and the ultimate nature, which is sentient beings are suffering. We want to free all beings from suffering, and we want to change our minds so we can do that. So, yeah. Compassion and wisdom. So the next one is hold to the principle of the two witnesses. And that's regarding our behavior, like I talked about just a few minutes ago. So, you know, the sign of mind training is if we actually become kinder, more considerate, less selfish people. So if that's the case, then it's noticeable. You know, your spouse or your children or your workers might notice that you're not quite as grumpy and angry and dissatisfied and stressed out as you used to be, because that should be the result of mind training, you know. And then, so that's the outer witness, the two witnesses. And the inner witness is your own inner guru. I mean, you know better than anybody what's going on inside. So that's the other witness. But the other thing, too, I have to say is that, you know, this is, I think I told the story yesterday, you know, where I was discouraged and Kirti Sincha Rinpoche said, you know, well, I won't go into it again, but just for you to know that it takes a long time. It's not easy to change your mind. And if you are interested in accelerating the practice, you know, that's why you do the purification accumulation practices like Vajrasattva retreat or prostrations or the kinds of things that can purify your mind. It helps to move along. Or doing things like medicine Buddha practice, you know, those are tantric practices and things like that, you know. But, you know, we've had these habits for a long time. It's not easy to change them. So please, you know, Dalai Lama says, look back over 5 years. Look back. If you can think of where you were 5 years ago, is it a little bit better? It's good enough, you know. Yeah, because, you know, there's that story about Maitreya, you know, Asanga, I mean, who went into three-year retreats, you know, and every time he came out, the first time, I can't remember the story, I'll just tell one of them. When he came out, he just felt so discouraged because nothing had changed, you know. And then he looked over and he saw someone who was trying to sculpt a stone with a feather. And he realized that it just takes a long time, you know. And that's really what it's like, you know. So, yeah. Then the next one is always rely on happy mind alone. Or always have a joyful mind. Cultivate a joyful mind. And so this one takes a little bit of discussion because what it means, it's talking about abandoning the eight worldly dharmas, the eight worldly concerns. You've all studied the eight worldly concerns, right? We're familiar with them somewhat. So, because what it is, it's being caught up in the eight worldly concerns that makes us not happy, you know? So I always remember four because they kind of rhyme, you know. There's praise and blame. It's like we get happy when we're praised and we get sad when we're blamed. So if we can abandon that and not let somebody else's opinion of us sway how we feel about ourselves. So that's, I mean, abandoning the eight worldly concerns, I think, really comes with meditation practice. Because when we do meditation practice and we do something like we did at the beginning, where you begin to experience yourself as connected to the guru, as this hollow body that's radiating light and, you know, can absorb all my negativity. And the more you begin to create that sense of identity, even though it is still truly existent, but there's a part of you, even still, that knows it's empty and it's beginning to meditate more and more in emptiness. That's why we have to meditate, because then worldly dharmas don't matter anymore. It doesn't matter what anybody thinks about me. It doesn't matter, you know, if I get praised or blamed, because it's not going to, that who I am is something that's stronger, that Vajra mind inside. It can't be swayed by those things, you know. Doesn't mean I can't recognize I make mistakes, you know. But that's a different thing. So there's praise and blame. There's loss and gain. And gain rhymes with blame, you know. That's how I remember. Loss and gain. So getting really happy when we get new things, you know. I mean, we can't help but get happy when we get new things. I mean, I think that that's okay, you know. But you just have to know that it's temporal, you know. It's not going to last. And we also have to know that making ourselves happy by getting things isn't really the way to be happy. I mean, that's the important part. If we know that, then it's okay to, you know, enjoy our Christmas presents. You know, you're not going to, we don't, you know, abandon eight worldly concerns by not enjoying. You know, that's being extreme. That comes in the net one, another one later. But, and then, you know, we lose things. Too bad, you know. We can't let that make us unhappy, you know. Especially, we can lose big things. We can lose parents. We can lose partners. We can lose children. You know, not just our favorite aunt, you know. So, yeah, and I think, you know, one thing, we do lose important things. It helps sometimes to think about people who've lost even more. You know, we may have lost our mother, but somebody in Syria lost everything. You know, I read the story about a man in Iraq just the other day. Did you hear that story? It's this terrible story, I'll tell you. Because Iraq's going through huge problems again, you know. And because nothing's working. And all these families went out to a Sunday afternoon holiday picnic, and they got in a ferry to go over this holiday, you know, Ferris wheels holiday place, and the ferry sank. And this man lost his whole family, his wife and all his children. And I think about 100 people died, you know. Just a little tiny ferry, you know, just going from here over to the Rose Garden, you know, something like that. So think of, and after they've been through the whole war, you know, they managed to get through the whole Iraqi war. And then this, you know, what karma. I mean, it's just incredible what goes on in the world, you know. I mean, so I'm not going to criticize him if he's feeling loss, you know. It's incredible. So anyway, loss and gain. We can start with the little ones, you know. losing my mala, losing my hat, losing my pencil, you know, losing my telephone. So praise and blame, loss and gain, fame, and the opposite of that's ignominy, you know, trying to, you know, about the worst thing you can do is to try and be a good Dharma practitioner so you're going to get famous. You know, it happens. You know? It's a little bit like praise and blame, isn't it? Fame and ignominy and pleasure and pain. This is a tough one, you know. How not to be unhappy and upset when we're in pain. But people who experience chronic pain, a lot of them can figure out how to do that. And it's pretty hard not to get overinflated when we're feeling pleasure. It's the same as when we have gain, you know. But just at that time, you know, that's, remember yesterday I said, that's when I recognize, oh, that's the one that doesn't exist. That's the I that doesn't exist. I try to remember when I'm having a really good time or, you know, I just was given ice cream or something, you know, that feeling, that elation, that one that comes up, that pleasure, that's a really good time to look for the I that appears to exist from its own side. It doesn't mean you have to stop the pleasure, but just stop the grasping at it. And then it can be a help. Because a lot of people think, you know, when we, maybe not so much anymore, but to practice Dharma, you can't have fun anymore. It's not true. You have to have fun. You know? You have to be happy. So that was that all the Dharmas? Yes, all of them, yeah. So, pleasure, pain, loss and gain, fame and ignominy, and what did I say? There's one I'm missing. Blamed. And then now the next one is the indication of having trained is reversal. What? There's something. Blame. The indication of having trained is reversal. And that means reversal of egotism. You know, when we immediately begin to start thinking of somebody, you know, there's only one apple left on the plate, and you think, oh, I'm going to give it to that person, instead of thinking, oh, I got to get that apple before anybody else does. Just simple things like that. When your anger gets less, you know? So it's reversal of delusion, reversal of self-cherishing. And then the sign of having trained is possessing the five greatnesses. I love these. I don't have it memorized, so I'm going to read it. The first one is a great bodhisattva. So when I think of the five greatnesses, examples of the five greatnesses, some of you might have known Geshe Lama Konchok, you know.
Wow.
You know, or Geshe Jampa Wangdu, or Lama Zopa Rinpoche, or Kiri Sensei Rinpoche. If you've ever gotten close at all to these great yogis, soliness, you know, it's incredible, you know. So the great bodhisattvas are always patient, always cherishing others. They never get angry. They've completely subdued their minds, you know. And I've heard from Lama Zopa Rinpoche that at different times, both Geshe Jampa Wangdu and Geshe Lama Konchok told Lama Yeshe, because they were good friends, you know, so you could be honest with your good friends, that they had completed the path. Pretty amazing, huh? And Geshe Jampa Wangdu, I don't think I told this story about him getting beaten up. Did I tell that story yesterday? I don't think so. Geshe Jampa Wangdu, one of his stories, Lama Zopa told this recently, that Geshe Jampa Wangdu was in the Pathankot train station, because that used to be the way to get to Dharamsala. You take the train to Pathankot, then you take the bus. And he got attacked by, I think, four bandits, and he was severely beaten. And he told Lama Yeshe that the whole time he was being beaten, he felt nothing but bliss and joy and love for those people. Just like Rigpa Rinpoche. Can you imagine that? Now that is someone who's completed the path. You know. So, great bodhisattva. Then they have perfected moral discipline, you know? They're always calm, they're not stressed, they just perfect behavior. And it's amazing to believe it can happen, but it can happen if you get shine and if you realize emptiness, which these guys did, you know? And then a great ascetic. It means that you can undergo any hardship for the Dharma. And, you know, when my first retreat was really tough. And but it must have been Rinpoche's hardship, undergoing hardship. Ascetic is the word. Ascetic. A-S-C-E-T-I-C, ascetic. It's like Milarepa. Milarepa was a great ascetic, you know. And Rinpoche must have done this on purpose because when we were at Tishita in 1990, before going off to do these big retreats, he took us, a crowd of people, over to this little hole in the ground that was over by, from Tishita, you walk over towards Baksunath, kind of over where, past where Kirti Senshi Rinpoche and Ling Rinpoche lived. And there was just this hole in the ground. And that's where Geshe Jumbo Wangdu realized emptiness. He could just sit there in the rain and the snow, and he'd already developed shine when he was in Simla, because this holiness picked a few people and sent them off to get shine, and he got it through doing the pills. I told you yesterday he didn't eat, and so finally Trigyen Rinpoche sent somebody up to build a little roof over his head. And so when my friend Roger and I were going through this hardship in our retreat, he put a sign up, you know, remember Geshe Jumbo Wangdu's cave and rejoice, you know. It's really powerful. Yeah. So ascetic. Never separated from bodhicitta. Their minds are always got bodhicitta on the brain, you know. You know how it is when you're in love and you can't keep, you're infatuated with somebody and you can't keep that person out of your mind? Like bodhisattvas have bodhicitta like that. It just never leaves their mind, and they're always right there for sentient beings, you know. And it's, then there's another description that says it's also, it's never, they have, there's no difficulty for them to do a virtuous activity. You know, like sometimes we have to force ourselves to do nice things, you know, for somebody. We don't really feel like it, you know. But we know it's a virtuous thing, so we do it. They never have that. They just spontaneously. And then the last one, of course, is that they've realized ultimate and relative bodhicitta, like they did. These guys did. And we met them. We know them. You know, it's pretty amazing. And you talk about also Geshe Lama Khonchak. Didn't he live under a tree for 12 years? He just lived outside under a tree. And I don't think he ate either. You know? Yeah, so, yeah. Pretty amazing. I think by then they had such good concentration, you know. But still, they had to get to that point. And the thing is, you have to first believe that enlightenment's possible. And then you have to decide, I'm going to get it. I'm going to do it. And that's why death and impermanence is so important. Because if you don't think about death and impermanence and the faults of cyclic existence, then you're just like us. Oh, I'm going to meditate for 15 minutes a day, and then I'm going to go to the shopping, and then I'm going to go to my job, and then I'm going to... And these guys are like, no way, man, I'm getting it this lifetime. You know, and it's like someone who wants to win the Olympics. You know, it's the same kind of drive, you know, that you decide when you're 12 years old, I'm going to be the best ice skater in all of Switzerland, and then all of, you know, it's got to be that kind of... So in a way, it's almost egotistical, you know. You have to have a strong, like, I can do it to get it, you know. You know, I mean, it's not self-centered egotistical, but it's a strong drive, you know. So, okay, we need to take a break. So one is trained if one is able to practice when distracted. Well, you know what that means. It means when someone comes up from behind you and, you know, pulls on your ear, you don't, like, yell at them or something, you know. And in the text it says, it's just like someone who's really good at riding a horse. They can eat, they can drink, they can, you know, take their clothes on and off while they're on their horse. And so these bodhisattvas, you know, they never get parted from the mind of enlightenment while they're doing anything. So if they get caught off guard, They don't get angry or depressed or anything.